Welcome to the fifth session of Depression and Anxiety Recovery. The first session, we gave you four recommendations to help soften the brain and help improve the hardware and the software. The second session, we dealt with what you are doing with your body and how your brain can significantly improve by making some simple changes on what you're doing with your body. The third session, we talked about what you're putting into your body and how vital that is in regards to brain chemistry. And then we switched gears on session four and went to the software. Once we improve the hardware of the brain, our computers can still not work optimally unless we have good software. And we showed you how the thinking part of the brain can significantly improve by analyzing our thoughts and correcting those thoughts. And session five, we're going to go on further in regards to the software of the brain. The problem is, if the thoughts are wrong, the feelings will be wrong. And in our last session, we covered six common errors in thinking that we're all prone to. And today we will discuss four more common ones and then delve into the deeper aspects of how we can manage significant stress in our life and some other good tools to help the software of our brain. So today is how changing your thinking can combat stress. The seventh thinking error is called magnification or minimization. This is when we begin to major in minors and minor in majors. And this will actually cause people to lose their temper. Anger becomes far more common, excessive anger. And of course, that can adversely affect a number of relationships. And so this is why we want to have our priorities straight. Many times we fool ourselves into thinking that we can't stand something. And that's when emotions start to get out of control. That's when we're magnifying it out of proportion. And it turns out a human being can stand a whole lot. In fact, a human being can stand virtually everything except for death or the things that lead to death. And to help people understand and put this in perspective, we've developed a song to an old-fashioned tune called I Don't Like It. And it goes like this. I don't like it, I don't like it, it's okay, I can stand it anyway, I can stand it anyway, I'm all right, I'm all right. And that simple tune just helps us to realize just because we don't like something doesn't mean we can't what? We can't stand it. And that helps us to temper our emotions. Now, many people want to be treated fairly 100% of the time. In fact, I would say all of us would enjoy that. But we need to realize we live in a messed up world. And if we demand that we be treated fairly 100% of the time, or we're going to lose it, who are we going to be damaging? We're actually going to be damaging ourselves. And we need to watch out for the HATs. We call those the HATs. Those are words like horrible, terrible, awful. When we're describing everyday negative events with HATs, we are blowing things out of proportion. So it's best to replace those words with more accurate words. Words like inconvenient. It's a hassle. It's unpleasant. Maybe even we can use bad if it truly is bad. But let's use accurate language, and that can temper our emotions. And it will produce a can-do attitude. Your emotions will stabilize as well. So let's talk about a few examples. These new laws affecting my business are terrible. There, that's an indication, those HATs. The terrible word that is producing terrible emotions, but how about reframing it this way? I'm frustrated by the extra challenges of these new laws, but I have the ability to work through the details so my business can succeed. Your emotions will stabilize as you reframe this, and your business will do better than if you stayed with your distortion and kept focusing in on those bad emotions. How about this? I haven't accomplished anything with my life since I finished school. Anything? I think you could reframe this. I don't have to be married or have an amazing job to prove that I'm accomplishing things with my life. I have something positive to contribute to the well-being of others. And you can see just by being more accurate in the way we are framing things can help our emotions and prevent that instability that can occur from majoring in minors. Now, many people feel like they have been wounded, and it's an imaginary wound that's caused by magnifying themselves. This self-arrogance sometimes we call pride. And studies show that pride comes first and then emotional issues. Many people can recognize the pride in others, but they have problems recognizing pride in and of themselves. Dr. William Backus, a cognitive behavioral therapist, gives us a little idea as to whether we might have pride. A sign that you have this inflated sense of self is when you are doing things to trying to be noticed. You're craving attention. You're itching for compliments. You're needing to be important. You're detesting the idea of being submissive. You're loathing the idea of admitting to wrongdoing. You're strongly opinionated and argumentative. In addition, he gives you a few more clues. Demanding your way, wanting control over others, flaunting your individual rights, refusing advice, being critical yet resenting any criticism your way, being oversensitive, and finally, thinking you have excellences you actually don't even have. William Backus says if you have one or more than one of these, you have an inflated sense of self and some wounded pride is coming your way. And you will have emotional problems and likely cause others to have emotional distress as well. So we want to have that humility, but also the sense of self-worth. Every individual is of infinite value. But when you think you're more valuable than others, this is when all of these symptoms can start developing. And it does adversely affect relationships. And many people don't even recognize that it stemmed from an inflated sense of self. Now, another area in which we can have magnification and minimization is when we start confusing needs with wants. And this is something that can even bridge over into thinking that you might be better off dead. Let me explain. It's well known in the psychological literature that the precipitating factor behind thinking that you're better off dead is feelings of hopelessness. But it's actually not quite true. It depends on what you're hopeless about. For instance, if you have a very valuable pen and you lose that pen and you look for it and you ask others about it, and after several days you realize that pen is lost, I'm not going to find it again. I've never had a single individual get suicidal over that. Why don't they get suicidal? They're feeling hopeless about ever finding a valuable pen. The reason why is they realize that is a want. It's not a need. And they can still live life successfully without that pen, or they can work, if it's very important for them, they can work on getting another pen like that again. And so people don't get seriously distraught emotionally over that. However, they have a tendency to confuse needs and wants in other areas. How can you tell the difference? You just ask yourself this question. How long can I go without this before I die? if it doesn't affect that, it's actually a want, not a need. And so let me just see if we ask these questions. Do you need air? Yeah, without air, you are going to die. Do we need water? Yes, we need water. We don't need it all the time, but we need it at least every 3 days. And as you have found out here, it's far better for your brain to be having more than 5 glasses of water per day. Do we need food? Yes, we talked about in Nutrition of the Brain that we can fast 17 hours and do even better. So we don't need it all the time. In fact, we can even go without food for days. But it's still eventually a need. Many people think we need shelter. But in reality, it's not quite true. The human being can do well without shelter as long as they have sufficient warmth. And so the real need is sufficient warmth. Do you need to have a certain appearance? You don't need to have a certain appearance. That's not going to affect how long you live or even necessarily how healthy you are. But this demand to have a certain appearance, or you're going to get upset or even think that you might be better off dead, is an irrational thought that starts with this magnifying it out of proportion. It's fine to want to have a certain appearance, but it's not a need. And so we need to keep that in perspective. Do we need things to go our way 100% of the time? No, we don't need that. Do we need an outstanding job to live a happy and fulfilled life? Not necessarily. It can be helpful, but there are so many more important things potentially than having an outstanding job. Do we need to be liked by everybody? We don't need to be liked by everybody. In fact, if you are liked by everybody, you probably are not helping very many people. Now, if you're emotionally intelligent, you are going to be liked by the majority of people. So if the majority of people you find are not liking you, then that's a real big clue that we need to improve our emotional intelligence. But being liked by everybody 100% of the time is not really accomplishable anyways by people that are doing a lot of good in society. Do we need to be perfect? No, it's okay to want to be mistake-free, but we need to recognize as human beings, we are faulty creatures. We can make mistakes, but we can learn from those mistakes and improve over time. So tips for recognizing and overcoming magnification or minimization is to have our priorities straight. When we have our priorities straight, it will build our frustration tolerance. And this is something that's very key in regards to your relationships. How do you handle the nuisances of life? Does it really get you off base emotionally? Or can you tolerate those usual nuisances of life? And if you can't, you need to go back to this magnification, minimization aspect of things. Also, watch out for the words must or should or always or never. That could be a clue as well that you're magnifying things or minimizing things out of proportion. The next thinking error that's very common is to personalize things. We call this personalization. What does this mean? That you're totally 100% responsible for any of the good or bad that happens to you. And you can imagine where this can lead. Blaming yourself for circumstances that are not your fault or are beyond your control. And this is what we call inappropriate guilt, and it can really cause some emotional distress. Or incorrectly assuming that you have been intentionally excluded or targeted. There's a lot of individuals that believe that when things happen to them in life, that they have been intentionally excluded or targeted. They personalize it. And very rarely is it actually the case. Personalization occurs when you blame yourself 100% for bad outcomes, or it can also be the other side of things. If you have good outcomes, you give yourself 100% of the credit. And if there's good outcomes in your life, there are others that should be credited as well. And there's a, you know, group aspect to elevate everybody here. And it's good to have that sense of gratitude that we have talked about, and that you're accumulating those gratitude lists every day. Let's give an example. That jerk just cut me off. I can't believe she did that to me. How can we reframe that? She may not have been looking, or she may have some sort of family emergency. Whatever the reason, she almost certainly didn't do it just to make me mad. And this helps you to reframe things and no longer personalize it. In fact, it's accurate and more helpful at looking at that situation. It can not only help you emotionally to think this more helpful way, but it will also help you avoid something that's becoming far more common in our society today. Have you heard of road rage? In fact, road rage in one year, recent year, actually killed more people on the highways than actual accidents. And so this is emotions out of control. It's a leading cause of death on the roads, even worse than accidents in some regions. And it's simply due to personalizing and blowing out of proportion what happened in that road and not really looking for another way of reframing that situation. Another personalization. My son got in trouble at school again. I'm a failure as a parent. Does that mean you're a failure because your son got in trouble? Does it mean you're a failure because your son comes home with D's and F's on the report card? Let's reframe that. While I have room for improvement as a parent, my son is responsible for his own actions at school. Yes, we may be able to learn some things that can help us improve our son's motivation and improve his own ability to manage his emotions, but we can't blame ourselves for this and particularly take 100% of the responsibility. So tips for overcoming personalization. As you identify personalization in your thinking, you'll be less likely to get hurt and more likely to give others the what? The benefit of the doubt. That's a sign of emotional intelligence. And then take time to think things through before responding, which is a great thing for relationships when you do this. The ninth distortion, labeling or mislabeling. By the way, some of those other distortions had that in there as well. If you remember that, what just cut me off? A jerk, you don't even know the person and you're already labeling that person because of what they did. We might be able to label actions, but labeling people, we need to be very carefully about. And some people start to mislabel themselves. That's habitually defining ourselves or others with a descriptive term that is not really accurate, and certainly not accurate the majority of the time. This can lead to upset feelings, polarized relationships, damaged self-worth, and other negative consequences. My father was an engineer for General Motors and worked on a car with four other engineers in designing this car. Had a new secretary, and the old secretary was one that they all enjoyed and loved. And this new secretary, the first week, makes a mistake, has an emotional outburst, and one of the other engineers who saw it told the other engineers, "We have hired an irritable idiot as our new secretary." Well, eventually that phrase got back to the secretary. And so the secretary's hanging out with the other secretaries and says, "This engineer that I am working under, I can tell you he is an absolute misogynist. This is someone who hates women." And both of them, in whatever would happen, would try to prove their labels. One with the engineers trying to prove the label, "I told you, irritable idiot." And then whatever he did, he would be called a misogynist by the secretary. So do you think that was good for the engineer? No. Do you think it was good for the secretaries? Do you think it was good for the workforce? Mislabeling can cause all of those bad outcomes. So we need to be very careful in our descriptive terms. Then we can mislabel ourselves. I'm so disorganized. How about this and reframe? I could improve my organizational skills. And so this is a far better way, instead of labeling yourself as someone who is inherently disorganized and can't really change. We had a patient of mine a few years ago who was undergoing a program that we were holding in our office called the Best Way Program, W-E-I-G-H. And the Best Way Program was for those with obesity. And part of the program was to help them identify foods that they had an addictive relationship to. And the first week, she recognized that she had an addictive relationship to ice cream. And so she decided she was going to make a clean break with ice cream. 6 weeks into it, she had not had ice cream even one time. She had already lost 15 or 20 pounds. She was doing well. But her husband, who was not coming to the Best Way program, bought some Häagen-Dazs ice cream and put it front and center in the refrigerator. And one evening, she was there by herself. She opens up the refrigerator. Oh, this is what I really used to enjoy. I don't think one scoop is going to hurt me. And so she got that Häagen-Dazs ice cream out, put a couple of scoops in, started eating that one scoop, and then she realized what she had done. And she labeled herself. She says, "That proves it. I am nothing but a pig." What do you think she did after she labeled herself a pig? She went back into the refrigerator and ate the whole half gallon. This she could have reframed by saying, "I relapsed on ice cream, but I was doing so well, I will get back on the wagon." And I know we may not continue that weight loss for a few more days as a result of this, but I can get back on the wagon. So tips for overcoming mislabeling. Ask yourself if the label is true and completely accurate. If it is accurate, is there anything to be gained by using it? This is very important. Often we fool ourselves into thinking these are accurate labels, but ask ourselves, is this a helpful label? Is there anything to be gained by it? Are you labeling an error or a person? It's far better to label an error than it is a person, but we have a tendency to start labeling people. And if this label is truly instructional, does it allow for positive change? If it does, that can be a very helpful label, and it can be inaccurate labels. So not all labels are bad, but we need to really beware of mislabeling. Our last distortion is one of the most serious because it's a little different than mental filter. Last week, you recognized mental filter is when you are only looking at one side of the equation and ignoring the other part. Disqualifying the positive, you are actually acknowledging the other part, but totally discounting it. Let me tell you the story of a young woman that I was seeing in our psychiatric unit when I was in practice in Ardmore, Oklahoma. We had a psychiatric hospital there across the street from the regular hospital, and I was asked by the psychiatrist to see this woman for a nutritional consult and to help her in regards to her brain chemistry related to her diet and nutrition. So I did the consult, and we were measuring a few things, and I'm coming back the next day as we had some of these measurements back, and as I walk into the room, she tells me, "Dr. Nedley, nobody cares anything about me whatsoever." I said, "That's not quite true." I said, "I was here yesterday, And as I was looking for you, I talked to the staff, and they said some very good things about you and told me where you were at, and that's when I went in and did the consult. So I know they really like you. And she said, Dr. Nedley, those people don't count. They're not part of my real world. Anyone who knows me knows that I'm rotten to the core. They can't think anything positive about me. I even tried to help her realize when I went in there to see her that family members were there visiting her. And there were other patients, too, that were enjoying her company. And she also said they don't count for the same reason. Now, what I did, although I was trying to help her nutritionally, and that's very important, I also called up the psychiatrist. By the way, she said she was going to be discharged that day. And I told the psychiatrist, I don't think she's ready for discharge. This is what she just told me. Perhaps she could use some cognitive behavioral therapy. And he agreed and kept her there and was able to help her with reframing her distorted thoughts. So disqualifying the positive is acknowledging the good, appearing to be objective, but believing the good side has what? Has absolutely no value. While thinking positive thoughts can help, the best solution is to believe the truth. So cognitive behavioral therapy is not just trying to think positively, which of course can help us. The best solution is to think accurately and helpfully. Another common distortion. I made A's on most of my exams, but I got one C. I'm a bad student. What is this person doing? There are several things that they're doing, but they're disqualifying the positive in regards to all of those A's and labeling themselves a bad student. The reframe, I try hard and study faithfully, and I'm doing my best. And if you did your best and it wasn't something that came natural to you, you might get a C doing your best. If you weren't doing your best in that course, then you can learn from that and say, I need to actually study harder, but don't label yourself a bad student. Giving up caffeine may have benefits, but those benefits will be worthless since I might have a headache for a few days as far as the withdrawal symptoms. What? It's going to be worthless because you're going to have a headache for a few days? You're disqualifying all of the positive. How can we not do that? Giving up caffeine will have short-term downside, but the benefits will be worth the effort. Disqualifying the positive is one of the common distortions that prevents people from changing from the better. They recognize there might be some value in adopting these new health principles, but it's going to be hard, and for me, it's not going to be that valuable. And so they disqualify the positive instead of actually trying to do something that they can do and experience the benefits. And often those benefits are far better than what anyone could have imagined up front. So if we don't disqualify the positive, it will help us with motivation. So examine your attainable goals, keep positive consequences in mind rather than disqualifying them, and it'll be very helpful to build up that motivational part of emotional intelligence by not disqualifying the positive. As we think true and accurate thoughts, it will help us with our stress control and the frustrations that come. And at some point in our lives, we will all encounter stress. Some assume the position that stress is just a part of life, part of having responsibilities and navigating life's unfriendly waters. And to a great degree, that's true. Life, although it is a beautiful thing, there are numerous factors that are indeed unfriendly, which place stress and strain on daily function. To better understand both the risks and benefits of stress, we first need to understand what stress is. And stress are the stressors, the things for that are external or internal pressures or stimuli. And stress is actually your response to the stressor. I think I mentioned earlier in these sessions that having a completely stress-free life is not very healthy for us. As we combat stress in the state of resistance, it helps our immune system, it helps our overall health. But we don't want to have the stressors overwhelm us. So as we look to reactions to stressors, phase one, when we're facing an unexpected stress, might be an alarm reaction. But if we're using good stress control techniques, we can begin to have that resistance. And that's when the healthy things can happen to our hormones, to our neurotransmitters and adrenal system. But if we're not resisting it, or if it's too overwhelming, we will go into phase three, which is the phase of exhaustion. And this is when cortisol levels come up and our body begins to tear down and our mental health also begins to deteriorate. So let's take a look at some of the health risks when we go to the stage of exhaustion. Heart disease can come about as a result of not managing stress well. Asthma is more common. Obesity as well is often due to not managing the stresses well in our life and self-medicating with food. Gastrointestinal problems are common when stress comes out of control. The immunity goes down. And even Alzheimer's disease and dementia is far more common in those that have not handled stress well. Other memory disorders that may not be Alzheimer's also go up as a result of this elevated cortisol, and we get into accelerated aging. We can actually gray prematurely, and we can get a lot of signs of accelerated aging on our system, which of course can affect our longevity and even result in premature death. Health risks from stress also come about from these negative coping strategies that lead to addictions and compound mental health disorders. Anxiety from improper stress coping can lead to frequent headaches, metabolic disorders, trouble sleeping, depressed mood, and increased irritability. So this is pretty big when we're not handling and managing stress well in our life. But I want to encourage you to recognize that we can cope even with significant stressors in our life healthfully. How we cope with stress is often an automatic response to negative impact in trying to maximize the positive impact. And all the different activities we engage in during a stressful situation are actually our coping strategies. And so we really need to look at how we are managing this stress. And are these coping strategies actually healthy for us, not just short term, but also long term? Stress with healthy coping mechanisms in reality is very good for us. And it helps our immune system, our mood, and we become better problem solvers. If we don't have stress in our life, we're not going to become improved problem solvers in our life. And our goal should never be a stress-free life. Coping mechanisms often stem from emotions, past experiences, and learned behavior, and they can sabotage our mental well-being. But healthy stress coping includes both cognitive and behavioral interventions to mitigate the complications of stress. So let's look for steps for a healthy coping strategy. And let's take a look at identifying those. And is there a way of avoiding them? Is there a way of eliminating them? Is there a way of coping with them? Depends on the stress. And develop a coping strategy. Determine how those stressors are affecting your life as well, and then create a solution to eliminate stressors through both healthy cognitive and behavioral coping strategies. We can also combat stressful thoughts with the tool that you've already learned called cognitive behavioral therapy. When experiencing stressful conditions, some people have a pessimistic tendency and are unable to solve problems due to their poor coping mechanisms. But the use of CBT can promote rational balance thinking to improve your ability to cope with stress. And coping with and managing acute and chronic stress requires dispelling persistent negative thoughts. So let's give an ABC example that some of you might be able to identify with. The activating event is your phone is ringing. And it's been ringing quite a bit. You're feeling stressed out. and you're thinking the phone shouldn't be ringing. It's always a problem when someone calls. It might be something I can't handle, something horrible. What is the consequence as a result of that belief? I haven't talked on my phone today, and I'm not going to start now. I'm too upset and tired to talk to anyone anyway. Why is life so difficult? Now I'm starting to feel nauseated. That's a result of that irrational belief. Recognizing that this isn't good, you then go back and start disputing your belief that's causing that emotional consequence. And your dispute might go this way. What law says my phone must not ring? To say it's always a problem when the phone rings is overgeneralizing and exaggerating. I can actually stand talking on the phone. It's not going to kill me or lead to premature death. I can even handle unpleasant situations. I'm not going to demand my life be stress-free. Can you see how different now the emotional consequence will be and the behavioral consequence as a result of reframing? And so this person will end up feeling a lot better and develop good coping mechanisms. So possible risks of unchecked distortions during distress is you're more likely to think thoughts that are irrational, unhelpful, which will diminish your emotional intelligence. Cognitive distortions during times of stress can adversely affect relationships. And we really need to underscore that because it's stressful times when we're thinking distortedly that's going to really start causing relationship issues that can last a long period of time. For instance, distorted thinking during distress can cause emotional and behavioral consequences such as arguing or blaming, and if not corrected, could lead to things like shoving or physical altercations. And when that starts happening, you are going to end up with resentment, anger, hostility, bitterness, and regret in both individuals' lives just because you didn't reframe at the time of acute stress and to take some time to do this. When we get to the resentment, anger, and hostility stage, this is serious, and it can bear a significant adverse effect on us or others. Decreased life satisfaction occurs when you hold on to resentment, anger, and hostility. And these things lead to something that is called bitterness. This will increase your blood pressure and cardiovascular disease rates. It will increase your rates of infection. It will increase your risk of cancer and cancer death. It will increase depression and anxiety, and it will decrease your life satisfaction. Bitterness has two paths. These two paths are the common paths. Once we get to bitterness, anger is a very common response, and that's going to result in hurtful words and actions, even more hurtful words and actions if there's already been a part of that beforehand. Another pathway is sadness. This is when you hold the anger in, leading to sadness, self-pity, and depression. However, many people don't realize there is a way out of these two dark paths. And it's one that has been studied in the psychological and scientific literature. Another better option is to choose to forgive. Many people don't choose this because they don't understand what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is a conscious, deliberate decision to release feelings of resentment or vengeance toward a person or group who has harmed you, regardless of whether or not they actually deserve your forgiveness. Now, this is very important because you are the one that's releasing feelings of resentment or vengeance, but you're not saying that what they did was okay. Though forgiveness can help repair a damaged relationship, it doesn't obligate you to release a person from the accountability of their hurtful actions. We don't forgive people for doing good or right things. We forgive them for doing wrong or bad things. So even forgiving points out the wrong that they have done. And it empowers you to recognize the pain you suffered without letting that pain define you, enabling you to heal and move on with your life. So many people with resentments allow this pain to actually define them. And it is not helpful for them mentally or physically. Forgiveness takes away hatred and wishing that pain and misery be inflicted on the wrongdoer and replaces it with feelings of pity. So we actually, by having this broader perspective, can actually look at the individual who has wronged us with a pitiful, more compassionate attitude. And when we do that, it's actually been shown to help that individual as well to potentially change for the better. It's accompanied by hope that the wrongdoer learns how hurtful their wrong actions were and that the person will choose to change for the better, which has been documented, they sometimes do, but not always, of course. So forgiveness cultivates empathy, promotes altruistic forms of behavior, facilitating the preservation of relationships and protecting you from prolonged distress. Distorted thoughts are the reasons why people choose not to forgive, however. And let's take a look at the barriers to forgiveness. This is a common one. If I forgive her, I'm excusing her behavior. No, you're pointing out the wrong behavior by forgiving her. It's not excusing it. How about this? If I forgive them, they may not receive the punishment they deserve. It does not release them from the responsibility of what they have done wrong. They may still need to pay for repairs. If they did something that's even illegal, they may have to go to jail. And you can forgive them, but it doesn't necessarily at all release them from the punishments they deserve. I cannot forgive him because he may do the same thing to someone else. Well, by forgiving them, it makes it actually less likely that they'll do the same thing to someone else, according to the research. And so this is an important part. If you want them not to do it, forgive them. And of course, that helps to point out the wrong. Another distortion, forgiveness is justification. And I want him to suffer as I am suffering. Well, that's not helpful. Nor is forgiving justification of wrongdoing, as I mentioned. There will be suffering coming to the offender in ways that you don't even realize, even if they don't get the immediate punishment that they might deserve. There's a lot of things that are going to go in an inflicted way upon an individual who has done wrong beyond just the legal aspects. A very interesting study was done on short-term effects of forgiveness and holding grudges by a university professor. To measure the short effects of forgiveness and grudge holding, Whitbliet and her colleagues studied 71 men and women who described an experience in which a friend, family member, or partner hurt them. Then they had to follow scripts that simulated two conditions. In the grudge condition, participants were prompted to rehearse the hurt and think about how the offenders should suffer for their transgressions. So, of course, they did wrong, and so you're just going over it in your mind and saying, this offender should suffer. The forgiveness condition, instead of the grudge condition, prompted participants to empathize with the offender and acknowledge that they, too, have hurt others. At least at times, they have hurt others. So the researchers found that when participants harbored grudges, they reported more negative feelings, anger, sadness, lack of control. What's more, their heart rates and blood pressure rose, and they showed greater nervous system activity. That means anxiety. While forgiveness was linked to better physical functioning in this study, Whitley had emphasized that it is important for people to know what true forgiveness is. The study participants were not asked to excuse or ignore the behavior of those who hurt them, but instead take a what? A merciful stance towards the oppressor. People who routinely ruminate over past wrongs chip away at their physical health. That's a quote from Whitley. And I would add that they chip away at their mental health, maybe even more, by not going through the path of forgiveness. But it does take a conscious choice to do this. To err is human. We have all erred. But to forgive is divine. And forgiveness brings freedom. Forgiveness allows us to replace negative emotions with positive ones, such as generosity, goodness, compassion, empathy, and even love, pitying love, towards the offender. And if we can have those emotions toward the offender, we can build those emotions much more toward others. And this will help all of our relationships. Corrie Ten Boom, who, if you read her story in regards to how she was deeply wronged and then chose, instead of bitterness, to go the pathway of forgiveness, she said this: forgiveness is not an emotion, it's an act of the will. That releases you from the emotional distress of anger, bitterness, and hatred, and allows you to develop positive character strengths, such as we have mentioned. There are also some lifestyle strategies beyond the thinking strategies that can help us in our hardware of stress and anger and even bitterness. The lifestyle practice mentioned in the previous sessions are also important for stress management as well. So you can also look at your workbook. It contains some extra information that you can review as you work on combating stress through behavioral interventions. Some of those we'll mention here, such as physical exercise. If you have been dropping off on that, I would encourage you to get back on it or to increase your fitness level at this point. We're already at week 5. Deep breathing, journaling, sleeping on time, and social relationships, not giving up the social aspect of life. Maybe even utilizing the essential oil of lavender as a helpful strategy as well. There are some lifestyle strategies that we would like to spend some particular time on, and one of those is boundaries. If you're feeling overwhelmed, it's time to think about boundaries. Identify what areas of your life are causing stress and which of these areas you can change. And although it's difficult to set boundaries, whenever there's a lot of good and helpful things that you can do, if things haven't been working out for you and you're under pressure, you need to begin to prioritize and say even no to some helpful things. If you're feeling overwhelmed, it's time to evaluate your boundaries. And it actually is not your responsibility to do everything. It is your responsibility to work on prioritizing. And if you feel it is your responsibility to do everything, you have no boundaries, and your stress management is doomed to fail. Another lifestyle strategy that's been shown to be helpful is working with your hands in 3 dimensions. That actually begins to enhance the emotional control center in the brain because of the way the circulation works with that front portion of the brain. I recommend you set aside 20 minutes minimum each day to enhance the circulation of the emotional control center of the brain, which is the frontal lobe, by working with your hands in 3 dimensions. It might be doing some sort of craft. It might be learning to play a musical instrument. It might be gardening. It might be not fixing your dishwasher and actually washing your dishes with your hands. These working with your hands in 3 dimensions has actually been shown to be quite helpful for stress management, just a little bit a day. By the way, surgeons definitely recognize this. They're having to work with their hands in meticulous ways, and I've met many surgeons who talk about the surgery not only helped the patient, it helps me. I actually have more ability to manage my emotions and think things through as a result of continually doing work with their hands. Another lifestyle strategy is massage. We recommend this once a month, particularly as a form of stress management. It's been shown to lower heart rate and cortisol levels. But we also recommend you look at how you are self-medicating for your emotional issues. And I really want you to consider never using alcohol, caffeine, or marijuana as a source of stress management. The area of the brain that is needed for wise decision making is diminished with the use of these substances because they suppress the frontal lobe of the brain. So the stressed person is more likely to make bad decisions that they later regret when they're self-medicating this way. And it will considerably add to their stress burden in the future. And so this is an important time to consider giving these substances up. They'll, of course, make the effects of stress even worse by utilizing them. Another nice lifestyle strategy for stress management is laughter in humor. And I'm speaking about real life laughter, not laughter from watching screens. One of the segues of getting into laughter is actually taking care of and developing a relationship with pets. Our bodies release oxytocin, a bonding chemical, when we interact with our pets in loving ways. And as you can see that picture between man and dog, you can see both of them have that bonding aspect in their interaction with each other. Oxytocin has been found to help protect the brain from the negative effects of stress hormones. And so pet therapy has been well studied and shown to be helpful as well. You can use stress and cognitive distortions to improve your life. And let's look at it from that aspect. We tend to think of stress and distortions in a negative way, but if we can identify the stressors and begin to identify our distortions, we are opening the way to improve our life. It takes time to isolate misbeliefs and a conscious effort to reframe and challenge them, but it is worth every effort. And I hope you've been challenged and encouraged that you can use stress and the power of right and helpful thinking plus forgiveness as opportunities to improve your life. You can employ empowering cognitive exercises as well as lifestyle and behavioral interventions to help overcome stress, anxiety, and depression. So I hope that you'll be willing to accept these challenges and incorporate them in your life from here on out. Thank you very much.